analyst Daniel Patrick Welch joining us from Boston. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now, and see you next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul inna salati wa nusuki wa mahyaya wa mamati lillahi rabbil alameen la sharika lah wa bithalika umirtu wa ana awalul muslimin qul aghayrallahi abghi rabban wa huwa rabbu kulli shay'in wa la taksib kullu nafsin illa 'alayha wa la taziru waziratu wizra ukhra ثُمَّ إِلَى رَبِّكُمْ مَرْجِعُكُمْ فَيُنَبِّئُكُمْ بِمَا كُنْتُمْ فِيهِ تَخْتَلِفُونَ وَهُوَ الَّذِي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات لأبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Top stories: rockets land near an oil field in a military facility housing U.S. forces in Syria. Europeans angered by lockdowns and vaccine mandates occupy the streets in several countries. And the Russian ambassador to the U.S. says eastward expansion of NATO is a major threat to Russia's national security. Welcome to the program. The U.S. military base comes under rocket attack in Syria's eastern province of Deir ez-Zor. Local sources say multiple rockets have been fired at the Al-Omar oil field overnight. The field is home to one of the U.S. military bases in Syria. There is no word on any possible casualties. The attacker reportedly caused fires which were contained by American troops on the ground. The U.S. forces then struck back at the location from where the rockets had been launched. American drones also began flying over the oil field following the strike. Lebanon's Hezbollah and Amal resistance movements agree to attend cabinet sessions after a three-month boycott amid the country's deepening economic crisis. In a joint statement, they stressed that the only solution to the current crisis is to have a strong government that can win everyone's trust. They noted Lebanon is facing an unprecedented economic and financial crisis, the main manifestation of which is the devaluation of the national currency and a sharp decline in basic services. The movements have been refusing to attend cabinet sessions in a dispute over the handling of an investigation into the deadly Beirut port blast in 2020. Hezbollah and Amal also criticized the illegal actions of the chief investigator in the case and his legal violations, politicizations, and lack of justice. Political commentator Mr. Paul Larudi believes that the United States, Israel, and their allies could be considered as one of the main reasons behind the crisis in Lebanon.
The situation in Lebanon has always been the government functions as a consensus or it doesn't function at all. Any of the various players, of which there are half a dozen major ones and many minor ones, can put a stop to any decision, can take action to prevent actions. Now, the outside player, this is an invitation to interference from outside forces. And the United States is especially, and its allies, are causing problems in Lebanon because of the interests of Israel more than anyone else, but also those of the United States. They want to do away with Hezbollah. Hezbollah is standing in the way. Israel, Syria is standing in the way. Iran is standing in the way of American hegemony in the Middle East. And the first one on the lines preventing, for example, Israeli expansion into the south of Lebanon, elimination of destruction of the Syrian government and so forth, the first one is Hezbollah. And so they have decided that that's where they're going to find their target and try to eliminate Hezbollah. And so they're putting all this pressure on the other parties in Lebanon to destroy Hezbollah.
Another weekend and yet another round of protests against vaccination and COVID curbs in Europe. That amid a surge of infections fueled by the Omicron variant. In France, thousands hit the streets of the capital, Paris, to slam President Emmanuel Macron's coronavirus policies. They are angry over a new government plan to further restrict those unvaccinated. Once approved by the Senate, the bill will require everyone above 12 to show their vaccine passes for entering public places. In the Austrian capital of Vienna, thousands rally against mandatory vaccination for all, which is due to start next month. People in Germany and Italy also come out to protest against new curbs. They say the measures violate their freedom.
On Saturday, Rome, Milan and Naples, Italy's largest cities, saw protesters railing against the vaccine passports that are now required to access much of public life. The largest demonstration was held in the Italian capital, Rome, where over 5,000 people gathered in iconic St. John's Square to express their anger at the Mario Draghi government's latest COVID restrictions. The new law has expanded the scope of the National Health Pass, which now can only be obtained through vaccination or recovery from the infection. Italy's public transport, restaurants, hotels, museums, gyms and leisure places are required to check the pass before providing their services to the citizens.
We are not against the vaccine. My daughters and I have been vaccinated. Furthermore, we don't hold it against the Italian fellow citizens who got vaccinated. It was their choice and we respect it. We are sick and tired of being considered just numbers for statistics. We are human beings, citizens, with our rights and freedoms.
The organizers of the protest say they are not supporting the no-vax movement, but are very concerned over the socio-economic consequences of the restrictions. Thousands of small and medium-sized companies that make up the bulk of the Italian economy have been forced to shut down due to the coronavirus lockdowns.
Retailers, shopkeepers, everybody knows full well that the new restrictions will hit them even harder. Scientific experts have explained that the vaccine offers partial protection against transmission or of infection from the virus. This green pass is just a way to control us.
Despite Italy recording over 180,000 COVID-related cases on Saturday, the daily number of reported coronavirus infections in Italy has begun to fall in recent days. However, scientific experts say the Omicron wave has not peaked just yet.
On top of the pandemic's socioeconomic effects, Italy is bracing for the upcoming presidential election. Lawmakers will elect the country's next president on January 24, with current Prime Minister Mario Draghi among the contenders. The possibility of a government crisis cannot be ruled out. Max Civili, Rome.
Moscow says NATO's eastward expansion is one of the major threats to Russia's national security. Russia's ambassador to the U.S. says five waves of NATO expansion have brought the Western military alliance states closer to the country's borders. Anatoly Antonov stressed that the bloc's efforts for the military development of the former Soviet republics are unacceptable to Moscow. This follows meetings of Russian officials with the U.S. and NATO. Antonov said that the security talks focused on the ways to preserve peace and stability in Europe by working out security guarantees based on draft agreements proposed by Moscow. Tensions remain high between Russia and the West over a host of issues, including the bloc's advancements and a conflict in Ukraine. We've spoken to Emmanuel Pastryk, the head of the Washington, D.C. think tank Asia Institute. He believes Russia's security concerns over the eastward expansion of NATO are genuine.
The security concerns are real, that NATO itself has started to operate as a unaccountable entity in itself, which seems to see expansion and larger military contracts, opportunities for global dominance as surpassing, overwhelming all international agreements on arms control and on international relations. This is a continuation, really, of the damage done by the Trump administration of essentially the United States and, to a large degree, its allies in Europe ceasing to engage in international law, international diplomacy based on agreed upon international treaties.
EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell warns of massive consequences for Russia if Moscow gives the green light for the invasion of Ukraine. The Kremlin tells the West that NATO expansion along its borders will not be tolerated. Jerome Hughes is in Brussels.
On Friday, EU Foreign Affairs and Defence Ministers concluded 2 days of talks which were dominated by the subject of Russia. They assert Moscow is preparing to invade Ukraine.
Any further military aggression against Ukraine will have massive consequences and severe cost in response. And this includes restrictive measures that will be adopted in coordination with our partners.
Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Moscow's patience with the West has expired. The Kremlin demands an end to NATO's military buildup close to its borders, and any idea of Ukraine joining the alliance to be ruled out. We have been asking EU citizens to give their views on the crisis.
There will always be tensions, as long as people have different views and are standing in their views.
Just communication and dialogue, that always helps.
I mean, Russia has got an enormous nuclear arsenal. We don't. Well, Europe doesn't. So we have to, you know, tread carefully.
I think we don't need any more conflict, no?
They should just find a middle way to live with each other and don't start a war.
We don't need any war. Of course not. We want peace, all of us.
The EU has donated more than 12 billion euro to the Ukrainian government since 2014. A European Court of Auditors report published last September showed how corruption in the country is rife at the highest levels. During their talks, EU Foreign Affairs ministers also discussed ongoing efforts to try and get the Iran nuclear deal back on track. France's Jean-Yves Le Drian told journalists after the meeting that negotiations in Vienna are moving much too slowly and a decision must be reached. But back to Russia, and the ministers claim they want more constructive dialogue with Moscow. But impartial analysts are asking, how can they be serious amid relentless anti-Russia rhetoric and the ongoing implementation of sanctions? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
the British Prime Minister in hot water for breaching COVID rules. Now the leader of the Labour Party is demanding Johnson step down in national interest, saying he is unfit for office.
Boris Johnson is too preoccupied defending his rule breaking. And as day follows night, when it comes to the National Health Service, you could never trust the Tories. Rather than concentrating on getting through the pandemic and bringing down waiting lists, this self-indulgent Tory party is having a fight about a leader who they should have known from the start is not fit for office. We've got a Prime Minister who is absent, you know, he's literally in hiding at the moment, and unable to lead. And so that's why I've concluded that he's got to go. Actually, it's now in the national interest that he goes. So it's very important now that the Tory party does what it needs to do and gets rid of it.
Johnson's been under growing pressure from members of parliament, including Tory lawmakers, to resign. That since revelations that he attended a garden party at his Downing Street residence in May 2020 in breach of his government's coronavirus lockdown rules. Downing Street is also accused of holding parties last April when mixing indoors was banned. Johnson's already made an official apology for breaching COVID rules, but he has resisted calls to quit. Guatemalan border guards have blocked the crossing of the first caravan of Central American migrants to head from Honduras toward the U.S. this year. Authorities say clashes broke out as hundreds of people tried to go through the Isabel border crossing. They say there were around 100 unauthorized crossings. The caravan consists of Honduran and Nicaraguan migrants. They set off on their journey on Saturday. Central America and the Caribbean have seen mass migrations toward the United States amid economic hardship worsened by the coronavirus pandemic. Caravans frequently face crackdown as migrants attempt to cross borders of the regional countries. Now in the U.S. state of Texas, all the people taken hostage at a synagogue are now free, unharmed. That's 10 hours after a man disrupted a religious service and began a standoff with police in a small town called Coleyville. Police say they have killed the captor as officers stormed the synagogue to set the captives free. The suspect's identity is not known yet. Local reporters said they heard the sound of explosions and gunfire shortly before the hostages were released. The suspect apparently demanded the release of a convicted terrorist. Now, the coronavirus is surging in India, where officials are reporting more than 270,000 new infections over the past 24 hours alone. The figure is the country's highest daily count in 8 months. It has raised the national caseload so far to more than 37 million. Over 300 more people have also died of the respiratory disease in the same period. That pushes total fatalities past the 486,000 mark. COVID surge in India is blamed on Omicron variant of the coronavirus. The new strain is taking over Delta, which led to more than 400,000 daily infections last year. Now, there are growing concerns about another health crisis. Time for one last story, and that happens to be in Afghanistan, where students are going through difficult educational conditions. An Iranian private streaming company, Filimo School, has made its online education platform available for free for all students in Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban is in Kabul.
For Afghan students, the year 2021 was full of obstacles. The educational system was disrupted and many schools across remained closed, while a ban on girls returning to secondary schools is still in place. Samira and Fatima are students of secondary school. After being banned from attending their classes, they decided to join online courses. Now they are students of Filimo School and they are happy with everything it has provided. Teachers and educational consultants believe that online courses are a good means of learning, especially at a time of crisis and pandemic. Mahdi Ishaqi, who is an education consultant, has found Filimo Online School very professional and useful for Afghan students. Filimo School says it has provided the service to Afghan students because of their difficult educational conditions. So now every Afghan boy and girl from preschool to the 9th grade can access the same lessons as Iranians do. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
It has been well documented that the Zionist regime often attacks Palestinian fishers directly. A total of 73 incidents in which the regime opened fire on Gaza fishers were recorded by human rights monitors between October and December. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Ahmad Al-Samak, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Danger Rises for Gaza's Fishers. Stay tuned for more. Beirut al-Ghara was 2 miles out at sea on December 24th when his fishing boat started to sink. He immediately headed back toward the shore, but a few hundred meters away from it, the vessel became completely submerged in water. Along with two of his workers, Beirut swam to safety. Yet three of his brothers had to be rescued and were brought to hospital. Luckily, it was around 1 o'clock in the afternoon, Beirut said, and some other fishers saw us and rushed to help us. The accident had a serious effect on his brother, Naif. If I had been stuck at sea any longer, I would have died, Naif said, adding, I have vomited every day since then, and I have a fear of the sea. I will never sail again. I would prefer to stay jobless than to go out on Beirut's boat once more. A number of Beirut's boats had been damaged by the Zionist regime when it mounted a major attack on Gaza in May last year. The Zionist regime targeted Deir al-Balah port in central Gaza, where Beirut's vessels were moored during its attack. One of the boats proved irreparable. The Gaza authorities estimated that Beirut's losses from the May offensive came to around $25,000, he said, but it's more like $30,000. The boat which sank on December 24th was named Amal, the Arabic word for hope. It was among those damaged by the Zionist regime's shrapnel in May. To fix the boat properly, Beirut needed approximately 3 kilograms of fiberglass. He could not afford fiberglass, so he used a sealant, which was cheaper. He had been able to keep working as a fisher using Amal since the May attack. Yet, when the boat started to fall apart on December 24th, it was clear that the repair job had not been adequate. Beirut recalled how he was nicknamed the King of Fishers as, "I used to have 4 boats." Before the May attack, he would earn up to $1,300 per month. Now, he makes only around $300, he said, and no one has paid any compensation for my loss. It has been well documented that the Zionist regime often attacks Palestinian fishers directly. A total of 73 incidents in which the Zionist regime opened fire on Gaza fishers were recorded by human rights monitors between October and December. The Zionist regime's naval forces even fired on Gaza fishers twice on New Year's Day. Khazar al-Saidi has been repeatedly fired on by the Zionist regime. Following one such episode of state violence in 2017, Khazar was arrested and detained for almost a year. He was accused of crossing the permitted fishing boundary off Gaza's coastline, a boundary that is often arbitrary. In February 2019, Khazar was out fishing with his cousin Mohammad when they were attacked by the Zionist regime's navy. The two men tried to escape but could not. The Zionist regime's navy fired an estimated 30 rubber-coated steel bullets at Khazar, while his cousin managed to hunker down. After being struck in both eyes, Khazar fell over and lost consciousness. I woke up 4 days later in an Israeli hospital in Ashdod, he said, adding, I heard someone speaking Hebrew and asked him, where am I? But he didn't answer. A doctor who spoke Arabic then explained to Khazar that he had lost sight in his right eye. His left eye could take about a week to recover, the doctor predicted. Despite being in severe pain, Khazar was shackled by hand and feet as troops brought him to the Erez military checkpoint, which separates Gaza and the occupied territories. He was escorted through the checkpoint and abandoned by the Zionist regime troops. A man came to assist him and brought him to the local police, who called an ambulance. When Khazar was examined by doctors in Gaza, they confirmed that he was now blind in both eyes. Today, Khazar seldom leaves his home. He said, "I don't have any desire to meet anyone." Opening fire is not the only way that the Zionist regime undermines the safety of Gaza's fishers. The relentless siege on Gaza has caused living standards to decline generally, and particularly among fishers. Many fishers cannot foot the bill for maintenance work on their vessels. The Zionist regime's import restrictions have also led to a shortage of spare parts. The shortage means that when spare parts are available to buy, they are more expensive than they were previously. According to one man who carries out repair work on Gaza's boats, the price of a new engine for a medium-sized vessel is now more than $11,000, almost twice what it was a decade ago. The consequence of working in boats that are not seaworthy can prove fatal, as the story of Muhammad Musleh illustrates. Muhammad, 40, drowned in September when the boat in which he was fishing capsized. Its engine had ceased to function. His brother, Allah, admitted that the boat was not in good condition, but the family had to keep using it for reasons of economic necessity. Allah said, "If we had had money to buy another engine, we wouldn't have lost Muhammad. But we couldn't afford a new one, and we still can't. I know it was wrong for us to go out to sea," he said, "but we didn't have another choice. I am a father of four. Faiz, another brother, is a father of three, and Muhammad was also a father of four. Who else will feed our children?"
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The United States assassination of General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis marked one of the most significant acts of terrorism by a state actor in recent history. Today we take a look at the fallout from this escalation and how it has shaped relations and tensions between the United States and Iran. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Iranian General Qasem Soleimani was killed on January 3, 2020, in an American drone strike near the international airport at Baghdad. He was assassinated alongside Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, the deputy commander of Iraq's popular mobilization units, or Hashd al-Sha'bi. Both men played an extremely vital role in the region, the importance of which cannot really be overstated. General Soleimani, or as he's also known, Haj Qasem, was a general in Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps and the commander of the Quds Force. Quds means Jerusalem in Arabic, signifying the goal to liberate the Middle East all the way to Jerusalem from the illegal occupation by Zionist and Western forces. The Quds Force helped to establish Iran as a major force in the region and to defend Iran and its allies in several theaters of combat, fighting against Daesh, the United States, and the Zionist occupation. Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, who was also assassinated in the same drone strike, was deputy commander of the PMU, or Hashd al-Sha'bi, which was formed in 2014, and is comprised of Shia, Sunni, Christians, and Druze militias, all fighting under one banner. Both these men were key players in the axis of resistance and a driving force all across the Middle East. Both the Quds Force and the Hashd al-Sha'bi were hailed across the Middle East by all ethnicities in Lebanon, Syria, Palestine, Iraq, Yemen, for helping to coordinate resistance efforts and defend their lands from imperialism. Soleimani and Abu Mahdi played a key role helping to crush Daesh. The irony here is that not only did the United States and its allies give rise to the creation of Daesh, they then claimed to have defeated the problem that they created and killed Haj Qasem and Abu Mahdi, who had done the real work. In reality, Haj Qasem and Abu Mahdi have done more to fight terrorism, which the United States created, than anyone else. But because they also challenged U.S. hegemony, this is their real crime in the eyes of the Americans, and that's why they were killed. So this is why the United States always labels people who subvert their imperialist conquests as so-called terrorists, when actually they are the ones openly perpetrating terror. The United States attempted to justify this assassination by claiming it had intelligence that Haj Qasem was about to endanger American lives. Well, where is this intelligence? Because we've never seen it. Is it the same kind of intelligence about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? If so, I would hardly put much faith in what U.S. intelligence has to say. They conveniently make up things as they go along in order to suit their foreign policy agenda and have no shame in doing so.
Soleimani was plotting imminent and sinister attacks on American diplomats and military personnel, but we caught him in the act and terminated him.
Moreover, this idea that the United States can preemptively attack countries and murder people is the same doctrine and fabricated defense that they used to justify the war in Iraq, to justify drone strikes, kidnappings, torture, rendition, and even murdering their own citizens in drone strikes. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and U.S. President Donald Trump both claimed that Qasem Soleimani was a terrorist, with Donald Trump writing on his Twitter that he was hated in the region. Not only is this statement by the U.S. completely baseless and false, it's extremely insulting, actually. You know, after they were martyred, millions of people came out to attend their funerals. Both General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi played an extremely important role in helping to crush Daesh in Syria and Iraq. So as a Syrian Christian myself, I'm personally grateful to them for this. They helped to liberate our lands from terrorism and saved countless lives from all backgrounds, including minorities and others that would have been killed at the hands of Daesh, terrorists that the United States and its allies helped to create in the first place. So this is why after Haj Qasem was martyred, we saw several processions and masses even being held in his honor, recognizing his work. Joining me from Tehran is Dr. Sam Torabi, Director of Risalat Strategic Studies Institute. Thanks for joining me, Sam. How are you?
My pleasure.
We saw a really touching interview recently from Haj Qasem's daughter, Zainab Soleimani, where she spoke of how her father, he wasn't just fighting for Iran, but you know, for all people, for a greater good. What did you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this has been the story of the Islamic Republic and the Islamic Revolution for 40 years, you know. I mean, the movement that happened with, you know, the Iranian nation and Imam Khomeini as its leader, you know, more than 40 years ago, 50, 60 years ago, was a global movement. It was a movement about, you know, truth versus, you know, those forces in this world who want to oppress people. And the movement in Iran, the Islamic Revolution, the revolutionary movement in Iran, decided to not go that path. And of course, this is based on Islam, the real Islam, the Islam of the Prophet, peace be upon him, the Islam of the school of Ahlul Bayt, which neither, you know, accepts being oppressed nor accepts that one becomes an oppressor. So this is the school that Haj Qasim was living. He was an embodiment of it. He was a manifestation of it. And so when the Islamic Republic, when the state in Iran decided that they're going to, you know, make those strategic decisions that they did, which ended up that those forces then went into Syria, that was part of a larger thing. And the larger thing was what I was, you know, referring to right now, which is that it's not just about, you know, preventing Daesh from taking over Syria or any force that's going to cause havoc in the region, or, you know, some sort of a cynical power play between Iran and its enemies. It was a larger issue. It was, as we say in Farsi and Arabic, haq and batil. You know, that was what the war was about. Those who lived it, who saw it, I'm sure, you know, you can tell us more about this. That war in Syria really showed us the true faces of everybody. It was no longer about the labels, you know, Sunni, Shia, Christian, Muslim, you know, leftist, rightist, you know, everybody had to choose, you know, haq or batil. And it became very clear very soon who's on the side of haq and who's on the side of batil.
So with the one-year anniversary upon us, the United States is claiming that, you know, Iran is firing rockets at the Green Zone, at the embassy in Baghdad, and saying that they're ready to retaliate against Iran. You know, it seems as though they're preemptively blaming Iran for something that they're going to do.
Well, I mean, all of them, Trump, Biden, you know, Democrats, Republicans, they're delusional. They think that, you know, that the Iraqi people don't have their own will. They think that the Syrian people don't have their own will. They think that, you know, the Lebanese people don't have their own will. They see everything through the lens of Iran. You know, it's a mental problem. I don't know how we can solve it. You know, they can't accept the reality that Iraqis would actually not like to be occupied and would actually resist. They can't fathom that. It doesn't fit into their, I don't know what we can call it. You know, the same goes for the Syrian people. The fact that, you know, the Syrian people would resist and not want, you know, crazy fanatic Takfiri Wahhabi, allow them to take over the country, and they would actually rise up and they would defend their own country, you know, with all the problems that might have existed in the system of governance that existed prior to the Civil War. Nobody denies that. Nobody says that it was heaven. Nobody says that there weren't issues. But the issue is, you know, what's haq and what's batil? Obviously, you know, people are not going to sit there and just watch their country be ruined. Same goes for the Lebanese people and their resistance to the Zionist occupation of their lands and the continued threat that they face from the Zionists. So these are the problems that we have with the West, with the British, with the French, and now with the Americans as the inheritors of the imperial powers, as the inheritor of the British Empire, and also to a certain extent the French, for those countries that were under French influence. So they just can't, you know, believe that people would have their own agency and decide that they don't want to be occupied and that they might want to resist occupation. And let's not forget, you know, we talk about the American embassy, but it's actually, you know, it's the size of the Vatican. I mean, it's a huge, you know, it's basically the Americans are occupying a major part of Baghdad, which is the capital of a sovereign state. And in many ways, they want to effectively turn it into American soil, which is technically what happens when you have an embassy. It's technically the soil of the country in terms of the laws or in terms of the ability of the country in which that embassy is located to enter into that area. So, you know, it's not a building. It's not a bunch of towers or a bunch of buildings or whatever. It's an entire section of Baghdad, which, you know, is being ripped away from Iraqi sovereignty. And so this is a problem. This is not something that can last in the long run. This is something that, you know, imperial powers do. This is what countries do that want to come and stay for, you know, centuries, which, you know, is again another delusion among the Americans.
Right. So, I mean, America thinks that, oh, Iran fired a few rockets in response and that's it. But they don't even really have someone of the same value or caliber as Haj Qasem on their side.
Well, what we have with Qasem, what we had with Abu Mahdi, these were exceptional human beings. These were people who worked on themselves. These were people who struggled and who reached a high level of consciousness, who reached a high level of purity in their personal behavior and in their lives. You know, let's not even go there with some of the things that we see. Many cases where, and this is all out in the open, where there is reports of massive corruption, personal and structural, within U.S. military. We have scandals erupting around the world where they are being bribed with, you know, things that I can't even mention on TV right now. And so, you know, these are like admirals and captains and generals and colonels. And these are supposed to be the so-called, you know, whatever army of the United States, the military forces of the United States. These are supposed to be the leaders of, so, you know, whatever mythology they want to create from it. And, you know, for us, we have to even not even put these two on a level where we can compare them. These are I'm talking about Haj Qasem, I'm talking about and of course, you know, the thousands of others who, like them, of their generation, after them. You know, when you enter into that world, it's a world where you have to really purify yourself. It's not something that is going to just go away. It's not something that is going to go away with sanctions. I mean, you know, just think about any other country or society in history having to endure these sanctions would have collapsed, you know, and yet we didn't, and we haven't, and thriving. Yes. Most Iranians don't have to worry about the basic necessities of life. Not only that, but we also have been able to really advance in ways that, you know, we were told the only way you can do that is if you connect yourself to some great power and become their obedient servant, and, you know, they will give you the technology.
Sam, thanks so much for your time and your valuable insight. Really appreciate having you on. Thank you so much. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
So after Haj Qasem and Abu Mahdi were martyred, how do you see the future of the axis of resistance?
Well, you know, this is another thing that's a Western problem, which is that their system of commanding and their system of leading is you have some heroic figure, you know, leading a bunch of sheep. And so if you get rid of that heroic leader, the sheep don't know what to do. But that's not the way it works here. The way it works is
right.
The whole movement that Imam Khomeini led is you have human beings being developed. So it's not that Haj Qasem was this person who is irreplaceable. Yes, he is irreplaceable to a certain extent in terms of a historic figure. But, you know, it's not like with him leaving or with Abu Mahdi not being here that things are going to change in any way, shape, or form. We have a system that's trying to actually develop human beings who are multifaceted, who not only look at things in terms of career and in terms of advancing their own personal ambitions, but in terms of building themselves and purifying themselves and self-edification. And so this is the kind of people that we have, you know, conducting the affairs, especially those who are involved in the military, whether it's the guards or whether it's the army or whether it's Basij or any other branch that's working. So it's not going to make any difference, because the strategic goal of the Islamic Republic is to expel the Americans from West Asia. It's the stated goal, as stated by the Supreme National Security Council, as stated by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, This is the goal. And it doesn't matter if it's Haj Qasim who is commanding certain forces or whether it's others who are commanding it. Or it doesn't matter even if it's Ayatollah Khamenei who is the leader or not. These things are not going to change with the coming and going of people. As you may have seen in the way that these Americans talk, they always talk about, well, when Ayatollah Khamenei is gone, we will do this, we will do that. Well, you know, this is exactly the same thing they said when Imam Khomeini was alive. They said, well, when Imam Khomeini goes, we'll do this, we'll do that. So it's this false projection of their own way of doing things, which is you have some heroic figure leading a bunch of people who have no, you know, ability to think for themselves. This is not the way it works here. And so with him or without him, the path continues. The strategic goal, as I mentioned, is the expulsion of America from West Asia. It's going to happen. And of course, in terms of Israel, it's the establishment of a Palestinian state, of a Palestinian republic, where Christians, Muslims, Jews live as equal citizens of that Palestinian state. It's not about throwing the Jews into the sea, which is the propaganda that the Zionists always, you know, use when we talk about ending Israel. Ending Israel is not about killing Jews. It's not about getting rid of Jews. It's about ending a Zionist apartheid state. Exactly the way you had a apartheid state ending in South Africa, and it's evolving into a different thing. And so these goals are clear. We are not worried about, you know, losing the support of this president or that president. And so, you know, basing whatever we do on whoever is going to call us from some second-tier official from the U.S., you know, ordering us what to do or what not to do. You know, accept Israel and we'll give you, you know, this much money or whatever it was, even during the time of the Shah, this was the case. It's not about, you know, being closed off to the world. It's about, you know, it's the system that we have in this region. The British called it, and still call it, Arab facade, which is the strategic, economic, and the security matters are determined by the West, and the leadership is Arab facade. This is in their own documents, and so these are the things that we're dealing with. Countries like Iran, countries like Syria, don't fit into that scheme of domination, and so that's why they're threatened, and in the case of Syria, you know, pulled into this tragic war that went on for so many years.
The killing of General Soleimani marked one of the biggest escalations between the United States and Iran in recent history, which is actually saying something given how many provocations the U.S. has committed vis-a-vis Iran just in the last 2 years alone. Many speculated that his slaying would ignite an all-out conflict. But one can argue that given the magnitude of this transgression, that Iran has actually shown unbelievable restraint. Just ask yourself for 1 second, if Iran had assassinated an American general, wouldn't America have declared war in response? Once again, we see this imperialist double standard where it's okay for the U.S. to violate international laws and commit terrorism while pointing the finger at others. Iran has maintained that its real response in order to properly avenge General Soleimani has not come yet, and that they are saving this for a later date. Now, 2 days after the assassination, back in January, the Iraqi parliament unanimously passed a bill demanding the expulsion of all American troops from their soil. After all, this was not just an act of aggression towards Iran, but also a violation of Iraq's sovereignty as it took place on their soil. The United States has been illegally occupying Iraq ever since its invasion in 2003 over weapons of mass destruction that were never found. And of course, the U.S. ignored this new measure by Iraqi lawmakers and has still not left Iraq. A few days later, after the assassination, Iran fired a barrage of rockets at the Ain al-Assad air base in Iraq, which belongs to the illegal U.S. occupation forces. No one was killed in this attack, but the U.S. hilariously claimed that 110 of its personnel had received, quote, traumatic brain injuries from this attack. Again, one cannot really consider this a true response to the assassination of General Soleimani, as the U.S. military does not even have anyone who is really comparable or of the same value to Haj Qasim, no less a bunch of regular service members, as they call them. Nonetheless, in another significant move, Iran said it would no longer abide by the limitations of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, or Iran Nuclear Deal, as it's also called. Iran said it would continue to cooperate with international monitors, but would abandon the constraints on the number of centrifuges it's allowed to have. This marked the fifth step in Iran reducing its commitment to the deal, after Trump unilaterally pulled out of it in May 2018, and then also slapped Iran with crippling sanctions, and also proceeded to order this assassination, which is frankly tantamount to a declaration of war. In the days following the killing, the U.S. Congress introduced the Iran War Powers Resolution in order to try and limit Trump's ability to use military force against Iran. It passed both the Democrat-controlled House and the Republican-controlled Senate, only to be vetoed by Trump himself. In order to justify this act of terrorism, the Trump regime pointed not only to the U.S. Constitution, but also to the 2002 authorization of use of military force against Iraq. These arguments are farcical either way. Just because the U.S. Congress votes to attack another country, that doesn't mean that it is okay or legally acceptable. Even if both houses of Congress wanted to limit Trump's powers in this regard, it's still not up to the United States to unilaterally decide that it can attack other nations. U.S. law does not supersede the U.N. Charter nor international conventions. This is absurd. It's ridiculous. And it's actually very typical of American exceptionalism. Agnes Callamard, who's the U.N. Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Summary or Arbitrary Executions, condemned the assassination of Haj Qasem and Abu Mahdi. She said the attack was an unlawful killing and concluded that the United States had violated the United Nations Charter. Speaking about a memo that the Trump regime gave to the U.S. Congress, she said information that Trump administration officials provided was remarkably vague and inconsequential as far as a possible imminent threat is concerned. Even at the most basic level, the U.S. did not demonstrate that striking Soleimani was necessary.
The targeted killing of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani, concluding that his was a violation of the UN Charter governing the use of force and an arbitrary killing. On January 3rd, 2020, the world moved into a very different space. On that day, the United States used unarmed drones to target and kill Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, as well as a number of his companions, including largely Iraqi representative. That is a significant and troubling new development. It is the first known incident in which a state invokes self-defense as justification for an attack against a government official outside a declared armed conflict.
Recently, in the lead-up to the anniversary of the assassination, Washington has said it is moving personnel out of positions inside Iraq for fear of, quote, retaliation from Iran. The head of U.S. Central Command, Kenneth McKenzie, said the U.S. is prepared to react if Iran tries to avenge Soleimani's death. Once again, this is a hypocritical, ridiculous point, because the United States committed the original act of aggression, but it pretends that it is somehow the victim. Donald Trump also claimed on his Twitter that Iranian-made rockets had been fired at the U.S. embassy in Baghdad, which shows that the U.S. is acting nervously and preemptively trying to blame any aggression that it might take on made-up stories. Iran's foreign minister, Javad Zarif, his rebuttal included a stark reminder of how the United States lied about the Iraq war, starting wars based on fabrications and doesn't really care about its own citizens. And indeed, if the United States claims to be a nation that promotes democracy and peaceful international relations, it cannot violate the UN Charter and violate international treaties and carry out extrajudicial assassinations. The slaying of General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi Mohandes was not just an act of terrorism, it's a stark reminder of American arrogance and hypocrisy, the real outcome of which we've yet to see. The United States can make up as many false intelligence reports as it likes and lie to its own citizens and the world, but General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi challenged U.S. hegemony, and that is ultimately the real reason that they were martyred. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
The Limelight.
Loyalists of former President Donald Trump attempt to certify the Electoral College in favor of the defeated candidate with forged documents, according to a new reporting by MSNBC host Rachel Maddow. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Chris Walker, journalist. This article is published under the heading Republicans in Five States Forged Electoral College Documents, MSNBC host says. Stay tuned for more. Loyalists of former President Donald Trump attempt to certify the Electoral College in favor of the defeated candidate with forged documents, according to new reporting by MSNBC host Rachel Maddow. Trump loyalists forged documents in at least five states where Joe Biden had defeated Trump and submitted them for certification, according to Maddow. The forgeries do not look like the uniquely printed paperwork that the state submits, Maddow noted, but they used very specific language purporting that those who signed it were the duly elected and qualified electors for President and Vice President of the United States of America, even though they were not. It's not like they created these documents to, like, hold close to their chest and fantasize that this had been the real outcome, Maddow said. It's not like they created these documents just to keep for themselves as keepsakes. They sent them into the government as if they were real documents.